Welcome to Discover Your Talent, Do What You Love. I'm your host, Don Hutchison. Every Monday, I interview someone from around the world who's discovered their talents to do work they love to create a life of success, satisfaction, and freedom. On Fridays, I interview an individual with many years of experience from one of the most popular occupations or professions who shares an insider's look at what it's really like to do what they do. I'm delighted to bring you our featured guest, David J. Greer. Welcome, David.
Thanks, Don. It's great to be here.
Thank you, sir. David, are you using your talents doing work that you love?
Absolutely. Every day.
All righty. Well, we want to hear that whole story. David J. Greer is an entrepreneurial coach, author, and professional speaker. He's the catalyst who gets you to fully live your dreams now. Spend 1 hour reading his book, Wind in Your Sails. Attend a one-hour talk with him or get 1 hour of one-on-one coaching, and you will have three concrete action items that will shift and accelerate your business within 90 days. David and his wife, Carolee, are committed to each other and their three children, spending time supporting them in the many and varied activities in which they're involved in Vancouver, Canada. So, David, that's a pithy summary of your career. Tell our listeners around the world what you're engaged in now that has you excited and motivated, please.
Right now, I created some extra time this year so I could take on more coaching clients. So I'm excited about that I can take on more one-on-one coaching. And I'm starting a new program called Grow Your Biz Quiz. And so it's growyourbizquiz.com. And that's for any entrepreneur that's stuck. The idea is you come to the site, and there is a short list of questions, which I hope will get you unstuck in pretty short order.
It's pretty amazing work, to say the least. It's a complex world out there, and people need all the positive feedback and constructive strategies that they can get. So congratulations on that.
Thank you.
As we've discussed, everyone's life is about turning points or passages from the day we're born till we leave this plane of existence. So please take us into the backstory of David Greer, family of origin, and tell us about the people and places and events and choices and changes that have gotten you here today.
So I was born in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada, and I was relinquished for adoption immediately at birth. And I was adopted into a delightful upper middle class family in Edmonton. And later, 3 years later, my parents adopted my sister Jane. And 3 years after that, my mother got pregnant with my brother John.
Oh, interesting.
And my first role models were my mom and dad. My dad was second generation entrepreneur. My grandfather started a hardware business in downtown Edmonton in 1923. And he then changed it into a wholesale sanitary supply business. And my father took that over after the Second World War. And actually, my brother runs it today. And if he makes it 3 years, which I'm confident he will, it'll be 100 years in business. So,
oh, that's impressive.
That is very amazing. Very, very amazing. And, you know, people, no matter what the economy, they need to clean.
Yes.
So, and then, you know, oil is a huge part of the Alberta economy. So that's an industry that needs a lot of cleaning. And so that's been a good business.
So what were you like as a very young boy? You know, it's in our DNA. So were you a studious young boy? Were you outdoors? Were you athletic? Were you artistic? Were you social? Were you a leader? What were you like?
I think it was a little more isolated. Like, I had friends, but I was kind of my own person. Mm-hmm. Some of the earliest stories, like my parents would get so frustrated because I probably was like 3-4 years old. I would open the door to the basement stairs, and I go downstairs and I climb up on dad's bench and get a screwdriver, and I come upstairs and I take off all the face plates on like the wall plugs.
When you were 3 or 4 years old.
Yeah, when I was 3 or 4 years old. And my parents tell a story when I was five. They had friends over, and they were really engaged with their friends and didn't notice that I'd got in behind the TV and taken off the back of the TV and was like pulling out the tubes. And
wow.
It cost them like half the price of the TV to get it repaired. And of course, you know, in tube, you have really high voltage. So, I mean, there was significant risk. I could have electrocuted myself.
That's a special ability, one of 19 abilities that people have been measuring for 100 years. So you were clearly spatial and structural from an early age.
Yes, so I had that. And then, like, growing up, I'm a big guy. I'm 6'2", you know, 240 pounds, got a big chest. You can probably tell a fairly big voice.
Yes.
So, you know, I grew 6 inches or so in grade 7. And, you know, my parents had me involved in badminton and tennis when I was younger, but was mostly uncoordinated. And then in the middle school years, which in Alberta is from grade 7 to 9, I didn't know where the end of my limbs were. And then I had the PE teacher in grade 9, Dave Bembo, I remember him. He encouraged me to try out for the volleyball team, which I thought was like a crazy idea. Like, how could I ever make the volleyball team? Because I was this uncoordinated klutz. But he believed in me. And in fact, I did make the volleyball team. And I remember one game, just having a really awful game. And afterwards, you know, Dave took me in his office and, you know, said, you know, what happens when you fall down? You know, the answer is you get up. But, you know, I didn't in the moment really hear his message, but later I heard it.
Yes.
In the moment I was too self-judgmental and, you know, and then he encouraged me to get on the basketball team. So, and I played basketball. And then, you know, when I went to high school, it turned out I was an academic geek jock. So
I'll be darned. Interesting.
Playing football, basketball, rugby, and track and field. I threw discus and shot put.
Good heavens. Football, basketball, rugby, and track and field. Well, man, you didn't have much time to relax, huh?
Well, and I was a straight-A student. And I also was on the social committee. I got minor awards in the social committee and, I don't know, another minor one. And I was sportsman of the year in my graduating class.
Oh, my word. That's serious. Those are serious credentials, to say the least. You had myriad talents, to say the very least. But were there other people in your life that saw different aspects of you that allowed you to have reflection on different talents that you had that you could deploy?
So I don't know about talents, but I had this vision for what I wanted to do with my life and my career from, like, grade 8.
Wow.
So we had a field thing at school where we went and we visited. So Edmonton is the provincial capital, and we visited the government buildings, which are in Edmonton. And I remember looking through these glass windows. We never actually got to go in at a computer room. And I remember seeing, like, all of this computer equipment spread out in front of me, and then the tape drives, like, spinning in the background. And I just remember I thought that was the coolest thing in the world. And then I remember, I think it was my grade 8. I remember a woman science teacher, I can't remember her name. And I don't, so I think we did our field trip with her. And I can't remember if she was also my math teacher, but in grade 8, I got taught octal arithmetic. So when we see 1 and 0, most of us think 10. And that's because we have 10 digits.
Mm-hmm.
But it turns out it can represent all sorts of other things. When you change the base is what we say. So we do all of our arithmetic in base 10, but you can do it in base 2, which is what computers do. They do it in 1s and 0s.
Okay.
And you can do it in base 8, which 1 and 0 would actually mean 8, because it means 1 times 8 to the first power plus 0.
Okay.
And these were, like, just blow my mind away kind of concepts. And literally at that point, I had this vision. I want to take business and computers and combine them.
And this was literally in grade 8?
Grade 8 or grade 9. I can't remember exactly when. But it was like a crystal clear vision.
Good heavens.
I don't know exactly where it came from. You know, I have this super analytical mathematical brain. So, you know, I just kept getting better and better at math. I took advanced math in grade 12, and I was, you know, regular math. I was usually finished all the in-class stuff, you know, halfway before the class was over, and the teacher would let me sneak down to the cafeteria as long as I didn't tell anyone.
Well, you were. I don't know how old Bill Gates is or how old Steve Jobs was, but you were in there. It sounds like a model that they.
It's very similar. In fact, like Bill Gates, I got in the same high school. I was one of the few in Edmonton that had a data processing teacher. And I took data processing and we had a way where we could use key punches and do programs and then send them to the principal's office, and they got put in a bag and sent to the Edmonton School Board, where it was run through their IBM computer. And then like 2 days later, you got your results. So I was writing computer programs in grade 10 or grade 11. And then I got my student account at the University of Alberta by grade 11. And I'd go over there and create programs. In fact, my dad hired me to do one of my first, like, you know, real programs, in that it was the transition from Fahrenheit to centigrade in Canada. Mm-hmm. So in Canada, you in the United States still use Fahrenheit, but in Canada we use centigrade. And because in the warehouse they made cleaning supplies by actually combining chemicals together. And my dad wanted a chart of like Fahrenheit to Celsius conversion. And so I took the bus over to the University of Alberta and I wrote the Fortran program, and it came out on the old Impact kind of printers and printed sideways. And I don't think I got paid for it, but it was one of my, my first, like, you know, create a computer program for some useful problem.
Yes. Well, so where did you decide to go to university? Did you go to the University of Alberta?
I started at U of A, but I had been in love with my high school sweetheart, and she had moved out to Vancouver, and I was kind of chafing under my father, and, you know, he also really wanted me to take over the business, and there wasn't enough computers in the wholesale sanitary supply business. So in January 1976, you know, as my second term started at U of A, I actually opted and moved to Vancouver.
Okay.
And then later, of course, broke up with my girlfriend.
Of course. We all know that story. Well, where'd you go to school in Vancouver?
So then after a year and a half, I decided I did want to get my computer science degree. And so I entered into the University of British Columbia in second year computer science.
Okay.
And then I had to I hadn't completed chemistry. And so UBC requires two physical sciences in first year if you're going to get a science degree. So that's chemistry, physics, or biology. And I hadn't completed chemistry at the University of Alberta because it was a all-year course. And so when I left after one term, I had to take it at the University of British Columbia.
Okay.
And that turned out to be fortuitous because in November of 1977, after a three-hour chemistry lab, I asked this young lady from the country if she would like to go out on a date, even though she didn't know who I was and she'd never met me before. But I knew who she was because there were five girls in the class and 250 guys. Anyway, she said yes. That was 42 years ago that we went on our first date, and we've been married 38 years.
Oh, my word. So you started dating her right then, and you courted for 4 years, and you got married.
Yeah.
Oh, my, how wonderful. Wow. And, yes, well, how interesting and coincidental that I have 250 guys and only five young women, that you went to class with her and that you actually met her and liked her and everything else. That's fortuitous.
Yes. I think the universe conspired to put us together.
Yeah.
So far, it's worked out.
Yeah, that's just incredible. So you had all these ideas because you're very creative as well as very analytical. But so what were you thinking when you were at UBC about the world of work, how you were going to deploy your talents and interest and personal style into the world of work? What were your ideas? I'm sorry, let me back up. Forgive me. As you were in school, did you have other jobs that maybe related to some of your interests while you were in school in the summer or whatever?
Well, let me go back to your previous question. We'll actually answer this one, too.
Good.
So I've gone back to university. I'm taking these first-year science courses because I have to, and I'm really in second-year computer science.
Okay.
And so in February 1978, I get a call. So summers in Edmonton, I ran a sporting goods warehouse. So when I came to Vancouver, what's the one thing I knew how to do?
Yeah.
Run a sporting goods warehouse. So I drove around, and I opened up the Yellow Pages for sporting goods wholesalers, and because that's what you did pre-internet. And I drove to every single one of them in the Vancouver area and left a cover letter and a resume. And eventually I got a job with two brilliant, innovative entrepreneurs running their sporting goods warehouse. So I had done that. And
now, how did you know, again, forgive me for interrupting, you know, you're super bright, but a lot of super bright people don't know how to leave a cover letter and resume. How'd you figure that out? I mean, it sounds obvious in this world in a way, but it wasn't obvious. How'd you figure that out?
I probably read a book or went to the library.
Okay.
Don, I can't remember.
Like, I mean, nine out of 10 people would have just dropped by and, you know, met them and whatever. But that was really very tactically smart.
Yeah. My parents. So again, you know, what are some of the role models? My mother had been taking me to the library since I was like, I don't know, 7 or 8 years old.
Okay. Okay.
And,
all right.
And so like going to the library as a resource and
there you go.
Learning stuff, like it was just normalized.
Yeah.
I needed to tell you about the wholesale stuff because one of the people I worked with there, he like calls me in February of 1978 and he says, David, I met this guy at a party on Sunday night and he's the MIS, which is Management Information Systems. Today we think of it as IT. He's the IT manager of Premier Cable System. And he's got this brand new computer system, and you need to meet him. And so that was, I think, Monday. So I called Greg Fleck, who was the IT manager, and he said, yeah, I'd come by and let's have a chat. So Thursday afternoon after my classes, I went and had a chat.
You'd worked with the fellow that gave you the tip. You'd worked in his wholesale store, so you're back in school, and he saw this opportunity, and he called you up.
Yes.
Well, that's incredibly thoughtful.
I know. And I've totally lost track of Billy. I have no idea where he is today.
I mean, not very, very few people would be that thoughtful and, you know, detailed to follow up. That was especially to put you in touch with Greg Fleck, for heaven's sakes, who was right in your sweet spot, right?
Right. And so Greg hires me. And literally at the end of the interview, behind Greg, which turned out is where the computer room was, this 6'7" tall dude walks through and introduces himself. It's Bob Green is his name. And he starts showing me this computer stuff and all the cool stuff it could do. And I didn't have a clue of anything that he was telling me. Completely over my head. Well, it turned out that Greg hired me to work on this project to rewrite the system that wasn't working for Premier. And Bob was the senior consultant. So I like worked equally with Bob. And in fourth year, I made the decision to join Bob and his wife, Annabelle, in their software company that they had just started. It was about 18 months or 24 months old at that point, as their first employee two of them.
My word. So you're saying in the fourth year when you were at UBC?
Yeah.
Okay. So after you graduated or during the
school? No, I'm still in fourth year. And then a requirement of my coming to work for Robel is that I had to, so you take Robert and Annabelle and you concatenate it, you get Robel, which is the name of their company.
Okay.
Because it's a made up name, even today, it still Googles pretty well.
Okay.
so anyways, the requirement of working for them was that, Bob had a strategy of thought leadership in this brand new area. It was a computer system that HP had just started making a couple years before and selling a couple years before. And so I had to write an abstract and submit it to the 1980 International HP Users Group Convention. And my paper was accepted. So then I had to write the paper. And then I was still in fourth year, and I had to fly to San Jose and give my first technical presentation.
Whoa.
Basically, my first presentation. And it was still, in fact, that paper is being kind of archived, and it's actually available on the internet, amazingly.
Wow. What's the title of it?
Check Stack and Controlling Stack Sizes.
Check Stack and Controlling Stack Sizes.
Yeah, I think that's the title. You know, I was 22 standing on the San Jose convention floor telling people about this cool software and what it would do for them. And I had no idea that that's kind of the essence of marketing and sales.
Right.
Right?
Well, yeah, of course. Yeah. Well, with great confidence and insight, et cetera, but still giving presentations is the number one fear of most human beings. So how did you man up to do that? Or was it easy for you? Was it natural?
I wouldn't say it's natural, but it's like I really, really wanted to work for Bob and Annabelle, and if I wanted to work for them, I had to give this talk.
There you go. There you go.
When you're highly motivated, you push through the fear.
Sure you do. Of course you do. Okay, so you did this paper, still out there. What was the next step? How did it go with them? How did you move through their company, and you know, what were the other challenges and opportunities that you had?
Well, you know, and the big picture summary is I liked the place. I stayed 20 years and okay. helped build it into a global powerhouse.
Wow. So you were the first employee.
I was the first employee, and a good friend of mine, Kerry Lathwell, was the second employee, who was hired a week or two after me. And the four of us, Bob and Annabelle, Kerry and I, we grew that company probably at 20% revenue growth per year for another 4 or 5 years before we hired anywhere else. But, you know, we were just like doing what we do. Like, mm-hmm. you know, it was way, way later on that, you know, I started telling people outside our industry and, you know, what we did. And it's like, really? Like, wow. You know, we just did our stuff. And, you know, some of it was Bob and I did turn out to be really brilliant software developers and product managers. How we kept staff low was we kept engineering problems out of the products so that people wouldn't need to call us.
Ah.
So we'd like, hey, you know, like 10 people in the last couple of months called us about this issue. Is there a way we could actually design the product so that they wouldn't need to call it because it would just behave the way they needed it to naturally?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, it's clearly in sync with so many aspects of yourself. Were there, I guess in all those years, it was just a continual learning experience because so much was going on so fast on the internet and
Bob and I invented three products that didn't sell well. I mean,
sure.
But we invented two that were home runs.
Okay.
Most people only get one.
Exactly.
You know, and one of our not successes was we co-invented host-based email around 1985, which probably several hundred people around the planet did at that time, but we did it independently, as did most others. So, you know, we were out preaching to people. One of the talks I gave in 1986 was the UnOffice, and it was about, you know, how you could use electronic mail to, you know, work at home and remote working, and we were doing that. I only went in the office one day a week, and I've worked at home since 1982.
Oh, gosh. Amazing. Wow.
So, and we went through. So there were lots of challenges. You know, I'm kind of glossing over 20 years. Lots of challenges. And, you know, we grew the business. And, you know, we did luck out and were pretty good about the people we hired and built this an amazing team. And in 90 or 91, Annabelle wanted to retire. And so I ended up buying out her portion of the business.
Okay.
And becoming partners with Bob. But there was very significant financial risk, and the terms of that buyout, you know, were fairly stringent in terms of I didn't make payments. And I mean, I remember leaving an accountant's office when we were talking about this whole deal. You know, and at this point I've got a 2-year-old and a 1-year-old, and I like there's tears streaming down my face as I'm getting on the elevator.
Wow.
Like just the stress, the, you know, like how big this is, the financial impact on the family, you know, and of course I'm fiscally conservative. So I immediately made sure that I somehow managed to put an entire quarterly payment that I would owe to Annabelle into the bank, like, you know, in a savings bond.
Wow.
So we could have a horrible entire quarter and not make any money, and I still could pay Annabelle, which was almost impossible for us to do that.
Yes.
But that's how I, you know, risk managed that piece.
Okay. Brilliant. Wow. Well, how did that go with you buying her shares and being a partner?
It went very well for 10 years. And, you know, Bob and I had a 20-year relationship, and we only had one major disagreement. But the one we had was a doozy.
Okay.
And so in late 99 or 2000, we kind of could see the end of the runway of this computer system. Like, it was one of the longest lived computer systems in the history of computers. It was, I think, launched in 1977, and they finally stopped selling it in October, November 2001.
Okay.
And so we were world global specialists in this computing platform that Hewlett Packard made, and that thousands and thousands of businesses ran their whole most important part of their business off these platforms. So remember, I'm back to my grade 8 vision.
Yes.
I got computers and I got business because we sold technical solutions, but we sold technical solutions to solve business problems for our clients.
So did you have a really large staff that did all that consulting, or what was the structure of the company like?
At the end, we were about 20 people.
Okay.
So, you know, on a pretty decent, you know, 7-digit run rate. And it was the thing that Bob and I were, you know, we were equally good at generating top line revenue and profit. So, like, we knew how to make money.
Okay.
So you know, I meet a lot of entrepreneurs who are good at growing the top line, but they're not good at making money.
Right. Exactly.
Right. So we were really good at both.
So when you hit this, this bump in the road, or this turning point, or this disagreement, what did you finally resolve?
So what happened in the end? So when we had had different corporate kind of vehicles in our time together. In fact, we'd had an R&D company from 85 to 90 or so that we co-owned, and I eventually became president of the R&D portion. And, you know, I had hired lawyers to craft this shareholders agreement for the original R&D company. And a fellow, Merrill Lecky, who's no longer with us, but he coached me and worked me through the shareholders agreement. And he introduced something in it called a shotgun clause, which is where one of the two partners makes an offer for all of the other shares at a price. So, Bob, I offer to buy all of your shares at X dollars a share. Mm-hmm. And then Bob has the choice. Either he sells me the shares for that amount, or he turns around and says, okay, David, I'm going to buy all of your shares at that price. And so
what's this called in the legal
It's
terms?
A fairly standard in a shareholder agreement. It's called a shotgun clause.
Oh, shotgun clause. Okay.
Because you're basically holding a shotgun up to the other person.
Right.
And I remember, you know, I was in love with Bob and Annabelle, and they'd hired me, and we were doing so many exciting things. And I said to Merrill, well, why do I need this kind of clause? And he said, well, maybe one day you don't get along.
Right.
And this is the only way to get out. And I've since learned and met a lot of entrepreneurs who either don't have shareholders agreement, or they don't put in a shotgun clause, or there are other kinds of termination clauses that are maybe not quite so, you know, all or nothing, but you need something.
Right.
And so in very late 2000, so what happened was Bob and I had two visions for the future of the company, where it's like, you know, we're coming to the end of this market. We don't know when. Could be 5 years, could be 10, could be more. Bob wanted to downsize, let go most of the staff, and service the customers that we had until they were all gone and turn out the lights. And I said, like, built a really special team. We have a lot of special capabilities. I want to take a little more money, a little more risk, and grow the company into new areas. And I think the truth is both strategies were very viable. Mm-hmm. They were not complementary. They were diametrically opposed ideas. And so in December 2000, I made Bob a really good offer with the shotgun clause. And at this point we'd become very acrimonious and kind of really hateful emails, and just it was a very, very emotionally tough time. And anyways, he turned around and bought me out.
Oh. Okay.
So there I am, January 2000, on the street. Got a pretty good size check in my jeans, because like I say, I made Bob a pretty good offer. And I still haven't really noticed that the dot-com meltdown is happening. So
right.
I'm like busy chasing deals. And then I met a woman who, through networking, I got introduced to her, and she specialized in helping really senior executives who were laid off transition to what's next. That was her business. We went out to lunch and we went back to her office, and she sat me down across from her and she said, "David, do you need to work right away?" And I said, "Nope, I got a pretty good size check and I'm not done for life, but I don't have to work right away." And she told me that in one of her career transitions, she'd gone to Australia and bought a VW van and just drove around for a year. From that, figured out what she wanted to do next. And I, you know, you see in the cartoons the literal light bulb moment.
Yes, yes.
Well, that was mine. Bing! It's like, oh, we could do something completely different. So my wife Carolee and I, right, had this plan. I've been a sailor since I, even growing up in the prairies, my parents had a summer cabin and I spent every summer out there, and I water skied during the week and I sailed and raced sailboats with my dad. And, you know, post-university, I'd bought sailboats. Our children had been on sailboats since they were like 10 days old.
Wow.
Every summer, spent 3 or 4 weeks on holidays with the kids on sailboats. And so we hatched this plan to go commission a sailboat in the south of France and to take off, rent our house in Vancouver, and to go sail the Mediterranean while we homeschooled our 3 kids.
Oh, my word.
And
wow.
We did that for 2 years.
And my word, 2 years.
We sailed more than 5,000 nautical miles in the Mediterranean basin.
Wow. We've had some fascinating stories on in 850-plus interviews, and some people have done some wonderfully exciting things like this, but it's very, very few, and I don't know that they've done it for 2 years, and that's amazing. That's amazing. That must have been, from every perspective, one of the most exciting adventures that of your whole life, to say the least.
It's that. It's so many things. It, like, you know, our lives are divided into before the med and after the med.
Right.
Like everything is relative to that. And people pointed out to me that we, in those 2 years, we spent more time with our children than most parents spend with their children in their lifetime.
You saw all these amazing countries. I'm looking at a map right now, coincidentally. So you just saw all these amazing countries and explored all these different cultures. And
how do you describe to people? You go 18 months without being in an English-speaking country.
Yes.
And you still have to operate. Like, you know, you run out of propane, the stuff to fuel your stove.
Right.
Like, you know, and it comes in a little blue bottle. Well, when you're in a little town in Italy and you got to get a new propane bottle, it's like a half a day project.
Good heavens.
And, you know, you take your kids with you and, you know, so they kind of see it. And you go to tourist information, you hold up the blue bottle. It's actually called butane. It's a little smaller than a propane bottle. And he or she doesn't have a clue where to get it, probably. But it's like, oh, there's a store. It's a kilometer this way. And so you kind of walk that way. And then you find someone else who speaks a little English. And you get them to point you somewhere. And, you know, after an hour or so, you go down a little alley and you move aside a beaded curtain. And lo and behold, there's a little store stacked with stuff up to the ceiling. And the proprietor looks at you and doesn't speak English, but goes out back and gets a replacement bottle for you.
What an adventure to get some propane. Well, okay, 2 years, 2 years later, you've got this epic journey. How did you decide to reenter the world of being an entrepreneur? What was the first step you took?
First step I took was a lot of networking locally. And then I ended up with a lot of entrepreneurs who exit out of something, end up becoming what's called angel investors.
Right.
Right. So I became an angel investor for 3-4 years. I looked at average 100 deals a year. I invested in 4 and 1 angel fund. And I did a lot of work on board of directors, working for stock options. You know, it got to a point in 2007, like I just was, I didn't realize how unfulfilled I was.
Hmm.
And I went to an event with a guy, Vern Harnish. He wrote a book called The Rockefeller Habits. And he's the founder of EO, the Entrepreneurs Organization. And he has this framework, and a lot of my entrepreneur friends believed in this framework called the one-page plan. So I took one of my young CEOs of one of the companies I was invested in to his training event for her and me to learn about the one-page plan. At the first break in the morning, there were two coaches in the back corner, and I went over to both of them, but one of them, Kevin Lawrence, he talked to me for about 5 minutes, and then he made me more uncomfortable than I'd been in a long time. I had tears in the corner of my eyes just from a few things that he said. And, you know, I had Kevin's business card next to my phone for 3 weeks, and the phone was way too heavy for me to pick it up and call.
Wow.
And then he called me.
Oh.
And he saw a spark that day, and his intuition told him that there could very well be something there and that we might work well together. And I ended up hiring.
What's his last name?
Lawrence.
Oh, Kevin Lawrence. Okay.
On my 50th birthday, we met for 8 hours. So Kevin's process at that time was your first coaching sessions is 2 8-hour dates.
Okay.
So we were all in together. So literally on my birthday on August 9th, 2007, was our first day together. And then we had another day, and then we started on a journey together.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Remarkable. Wow. Bravo. To say the very least, this is an epic story. So what do you say with this amazing career and all this experience, David, about what Gallup has told us since 1990, by the way, about the workplace and people's satisfaction or lack thereof? 84% of people not engaged, 60 around the world, 67% in this country, 92% of people in Japan, coincidentally. It's an arduous journey, to say the very least, maybe the hardest part of our existence in many ways. Why is it so hard for people to use their talents and create a strategy and a plan and a life to use the best of what they are and create a life on their best terms?
I think there's just a lot of systemic stuff. So I think that there's a lot of media, Hollywood, parents that, like, to be successful, you have to be financially successful.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, like, so there's this notion of success. Just like even, you know, from old fairy tales and Hollywood and Disney, you know, the prince meets the princess and they live happily ever after.
Yes.
I've been married 38 years. Let me tell you, it doesn't work that way.
No. No.
You got to work at your relationship. A lot sometimes.
Yes.
Right? And you have to change and grow, as does your partner.
Right.
So I think that a lot of us buy into this whole myth about, you know, you've got to grow up and you got to buy a house and you got to have kids. And, you know, to do all of that, you got to have a job because that's how you pay for it all.
Right.
So one is you're breaking to the norm if you don't follow that path.
That's right.
So I think that's part of it. And then, you know, I think there's just, I do a lot of work around culture.
Yes. So
a lot of my work is helping people understand their culture, really decide, make conscious choice for what they want their culture to be. And in most corporate cultures, like, you cannot be vulnerable.
It's right.
It is totally unacceptable. I spent a fair amount of time yesterday with a good friend of mine who works for one of the five most richest companies in the entire world. And at that company, it's a sign of massive weakness for you to be the slightest bit vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
And you are not rewarded for being honest. Mm-hmm. Even when it's plain to everyone what the elephant on the table is, you are not rewarded by saying, hey, why are we not looking at the elephant?
Right.
Right?
Yes.
So, when you have such pervasiveness in our corporate cultures that look like that, like, how the hell could anyone be happy in that kind of environment? I guess I would say.
Right.
Right. And I don't work with those kind of people.
Right. Right.
I don't, you know, state to my clients, what kind of culture do you have? But, you know, there's just certain kind of CEOs that I'm not going to want to work with.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
And, you know, I only want to work with people that I love to work with.
Yes.
That's just like, you know, for 20 years, I loved being at Robel. Like, it was never a burden. I mean, I shouldn't say that. There are days, everybody has off days, and there were times and challenges were hard enough that, you know, you wonder why you're doing this. But, you know, my belief is you learn more from your failures than you do from your wins.
Right.
Right?
Yes.
So,
yes.
And every challenge you've had in your life has set you up perfectly for wherever you are right now.
Yes, exactly, exactly. Okay, you attract those kind of people because you see the people that are stuck in the matrix and don't know they are and don't care or don't have enough insight to realize it. What is your process? We don't have a lot of time left here, but I want to hear just briefly what your process is for getting them to get outside the box.
I exclusively work with entrepreneurs or super, super high performers.
Right.
I have a client who's gone to 4 Olympics, and she decided this year, even though she's building a fantastic executive coaching practice, that she's going to go for her 5th.
Wow.
Like, that is high performing.
Wow.
And I'm very confident she's going to be there. So I need people who are open to some help. I meet tons of entrepreneurs who need help. They're not open to it. So I just, you know, I stay in touch, and maybe one day they will be.
Right. Right, right.
Right? Like, you know, Kevin saw me, and he caused me to cry, and I realized, like, I frickin' need a lot of help.
Right. Yes, 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 exactly.
And so I was ready. And then, you know, my process is I have an intake sheet. So, you know, part of that is you've got to tell me, like, at least 2 or 3 goals you have for 6 months, for 12 months, and for 18 months. And since most people come to me with business problems, usually we start with business goals. And as we work together, they'll probably start adding some, you know, personal goals and some life goals. But I don't necessarily insist on that to begin with. So you have to have some kind of vision for where it is that you want to go. And I might have to help coach you to get those down. And then, you know, and then I have a coaching agreement. I think that's critical. And what I've been taught in my coach training is that you need, you know, like I will ask people when we're getting to the point of signing the contract is, you know, are you okay having me coach you?
Mm-hmm.
Because if they say no at that point, there's no point signing the contract.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
And I offer pretty much anyone 1 hour free coaching if they want. And like, if I do that, then you know, the first thing I promise them is that whatever is everything they say to me will be confidential. And the second thing I say is, is it okay if I coach you today?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's part of the coaching agreement. So my coaching agreement is not that arduous, but there are, you know, if I'm coaching you and in a coaching call, you agree to do something, then you promise that within 24 hours, you're going to send me the list of things you promised to do.
Yes.
You can email it to me. Like that's like a core accountability piece. So if you want to work with me, like that's part of what you have to agree to. And then and I agree to things like if something doesn't work in a session, I want you to tell me. And if you tell me, I promise you within 24 hours, I'll have some solution.
Wow.
Might not be the perfect solution, but it will be, you know, next time we will try this. Or
yes, yes.
Right. Again, there's a commitment on me to get back to you right away. And so intake form with some goals. And then a coaching agreement. And then we book your first month or two of meetings. Like, so that it's, I try to make it as easy as possible, but we do have to have some of these agreements and mechanical things in place because they're the final kind of testing ground of, can I work with you and can you work with me?
Yes, exactly.
And when people approach me, you know, I'll say, you know, are you talking to 2 or 3 other coaches? Because I want you to. I want you to find the coach who you relate to the most. And that's way more important to me than whether I get another coaching client.
Right.
Much I would love to coach you. Don't get me
right.
wrong.
Right.
But if I'm, you know, if you're not ecstatic or at least pretty excited about it, then you should find someone else who you are.
Right. Exactly, exactly.
And
wow.
Comes back full circle to, you know, so what's wrong with corporate America? Well, because people go take jobs they're not super excited about. And they work with people who they don't love working with.
Right. You hit the problem on the head. I co-authored a book, one of my first book I co-authored with Dr. McDonald called The Lemming Conspiracy. And he was a genius psychologist, great friend of mine. And I knew about systems conceptually, but that's what he had his PhD in. And when you understand systems, whether it's family, organization, mm-hmm. school, religion, it doesn't matter. Systems, that's what happens. That's what the lemming conspiracy is. You get in the system. It doesn't matter if you're brilliant. The system doesn't know you. It has its own protocols, and it just moves forward. It doesn't have a heart and a soul and a brain. It's just a good structural way. They work. Systems are important, just like a structure on a building. But it's not the heart and soul that can't get to you. So you're
right. And one advantage I have, like as a computer scientist, everything in software is a system.
Exactly.
So all my training is around systems. So, you know, that very much, you know, for better or for worse, I think mostly for the better, colors my thinking.
Because I see everything, too.
Right? As an interacting system.
Yes. It's amazing. So in just a couple of sentences, what's your personal vision going forward?
My personal vision, my big, hairy, audacious goal,
yes,
career-wise, is to help 100,000 entrepreneurs step into their single biggest challenge.
Wow. Okay.
And, you know, my personal goal is to stay married to Carol Lee in a healthy, supportive relationship and connected to our three children and their significant others. And then on top of that, 10 months ago, our daughter had our firstborn.
Oh, so, congratulations.
So, and then of course, connection to our grandchildren, which we now have one, a beautiful grandson who we're very connected to.
Yes, yes.
So that's my personal vision.
Yes. And your single greatest talent is?
Getting things done. I'm serious.
No, I'm laughing.
Getting things done.
No, you can't do better than that. You can't do better than that. Just do it. Just do it, right? Well, David J. Greer, what a great pleasure being with you today. We so much appreciate you sharing the highlights of your remarkable life journey. And I know that listeners around the world have learned many lessons that will help them on theirs. So tell those listeners how they connect with you.
The easiest way is my website. So, you know, I'm David J. Greer, and my website is Coach, D as in David, J as in James, Greer.com.
Excellent. Listeners know you can go to discoveryourtalentpodcast.com, click on podcast in the navigation bar, and there you'll find the show notes of this fine, fine interview. In closing, every one of us is born with unique talents and gifts. We don't learn them. We can't ignore them. They're just a part of who we are, our DNA. Whenever we discover them and use them in our lives and careers, we do not merely survive, we thrive in every way possible. So until next time, all my best, and whatever you do, have fun out there today.